The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning, how are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement. And I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on RadioKerry.ie, on the Radio Kerry app or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. It is a glorious morning here in the kingdom. The sun is shining down Greens of Spare and it is absolutely beautiful. And a big welcome to our Armagh friends in inverted commas. I don't know how friendly we'll be later on today. Hopefully you won't be going home too happy, but hopefully you enjoy your time while you're here. And of course, Radio Kerry, Tim and Ambrose will be bringing you live coverage of that at 4 o'clock. And we are very much looking forward to that. We have a very busy programme for you this morning on the Saturday Supplement. We will be speaking to Pat Nelligan about his book, The Spy in the Snug and Other Tales from the Dingle Peninsula. I also visited Bridie's or Keating's Bar, but Bridie's is what it is affectionately known as in Derrynane, which is celebrating 100 years and whose building dates back to the famine times. And Bridie herself, there was two Bridie's, but the Bridie that a lot of people would have known passed away in 2018. She was an institution in that area. So we're going to be talking to her niece, Geraldine Keating, who now runs the place, and it's just steeped in history. So that'll be in the next hour. And we'll also in the next hour be speaking to artist Aisling Roach about her new exhibition in Killorglan in the Grills Gallery, drawing inspiration from maritime ecological systems. If you want to get in touch with the programme, Dervla's take your calls on 066 712 3666. You can text the WhatsApp 083 300 3300. But first, The Spy in the Snug and Other Tales from Dingle Peninsula is written by Pat Nelligan. And the Dingle Peninsula, that remote finger of land stretching onto the Atlantic Ocean, has witnessed many momentous events through the ages. In this book, Pat takes readers on a whistle-stop tour of his home place in a lively mix of tales spanning over 500 years of history, packed with heroes and villains, moments of disaster and daring. This well-researched and richly illustrated compendium will captivate anyone who wants to understand the drama of this place and its people. And I have to say, Pat joins me now. It is so well written. And I was saying to Pat off here that it's, you can kind of have an a la carte nature to it. You can nip in and out of each story, Pat. It's wonderfully put together. But firstly, you're very welcome. And tell us, why did you decide to write this book?
Well, this book has been a long time in the making. It began actually when I was 11 years of age, would you believe, and one story I heard then, that I read then, has stayed in my mind until I'm, of course I'm almost 80 now, but it has stayed in my mind since then. And yeah, that was the first book, or sorry, the first story that was selected for inclusion in the book. I was at home one day, I was about 11, and my dad came in with a Sunday Press. Now, this was a bit of a surprise because he wasn't really Fianna Fáil supporter. He was, I think, secretly Fine Gael, being a small farmer and a shopkeeper. But his wife, of course, my mother, was strongly Fianna Fáil, coming from Dúnshin. So I think for peace in the valley, they never discussed politics, really. So anyway, he gave me the book, the Sunday Press, and splashed across the front page was this wonderful story of a cliff rescue in Ballagawe in 1956. The story appeared in 1958. And that story was so vividly written by a Dingle man, Michael O'Halloran from Green Street. And the whole event was such a wonderful story of human bravery. A man who was married with a family went down into this cliff to rescue a French fisherman who was trapped in the cliff. And where he went, I went to visit it recently again with my daughter. It was a horrifying place, about 600 feet high. He went down that cliff just armed with a rope and rescued this French sailor. It was a fantastic, I think, moment of putting the good of humanity before one's personal safety.
Yeah, because he wouldn't have known him. No connection to him.
No connection whatsoever. Well, the man's name was John O'Connor, and his nickname was Towel. He was called the Towel. In his young days, he had been a fantastic footballer, an oarsman. He'd won everything that was going, the Cuas canoe and all that gang. And he was still, even though he was in his 50s, late 50s, he was still a strong, hardy man. I think nobody else could have done it.
Yeah.
The story is, it just remained in my mind for all that time. So when I was writing this book, that was the very first story that I had to go into the book.
Yeah. What's the Coos Canoe?
Well, there was a huge rivalry between the various villages and parishes back the west for these canoe races in the past. Not so much now, I think.
Yeah.
But and the Coos Canoe was very famous at one particular time. It was the boat to beat. You had crews from the island, you had crews from Ventry, crews from Marys, from all over, but the crew from Coos were the men to beat in the 60s, 50s and 60s.
And these weren't Navogues, these were canoes?
Navogues.
Oh, they were Navogues. Oh, right. it's the canoe.
The canoe, yeah, okay. You're quite right.
Amazing. Yeah. That's the book that kind of inspired you, but the name of the book is The Spy in the Snug.
Correct.
And yes. that why did you lead with that as the title?
Well, this is the signature story, I suppose, yeah, really, because it's closest to my heart and closest to home. In 1940, a spy landed in Dingle, near Minard Castle, and made his way to Dingle, and by luck met my father at 7:30 in the morning. There was nobody else up. My grandfather, was going milking his cows, and he spoke to the stranger on the bridge, on the small bridge, Dingle. And he said, "Why don't you come in?" He was waiting for the bus to Tralee. "Come into the bar and meet my wife. She look after you." And he had a few glasses of whiskey, and he had bacon and eggs and sausages, the usual stuff. And then, as his tongue loosened, my grandmother began to ask him a few questions. And she soon realised he was not what he appeared to be. He pretended to be a fisherman who had fishing boats in Dingle, visiting his sister in Annascull, and that he had to go to a doctor in Dublin. He had three or four stories mixed in together. Anyway, she could see he had sand on his shoes. He spoke with a foreign accent. He had a little brown bag he never left out of his sight. It was filled with money, dollars and sterling. She didn't know that, but when he paid for his drink, she said he paid for, with a great Dingle word, a gwall of money. And so she got word to the local superintendent, who was a daily mass goer. And he got instructions from Dublin not to arrest him, but to keep an eye on him, see whom he met, because if he met the IRA, that would have implications, of course. So he made his way in the bus to Tralee, and his tongue was loosening, of course, and he invited the other passengers to have a glass of whiskey as well that he brought with him.
This guy was no James Bond, I think.
Well, he was a fine cut of a man. He led a most interesting life.
Yeah.
He fished in the southern oceans and the Antarctic, and he'd hunted whales, and he'd done every kind of thing.
In his mind, or did he do it?
He actually did.
He did, yeah. Okay.
He was a real kind of James Bond type in that sense.
Yeah.
But
so he's on the train, he's telling everyone.
He's on the train, and he spotted these two large gentlemen were watching him in at Tralee station. And he soon realised they were the police, they were on to him. So on the way to Dublin, the train stopped, and they phoned ahead. And there was a reception committee waiting for him at Houston station, and he was brought off to jail. And he spent 4 years in jail in Ireland, even though he had achieved absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Was that in Tintown now, or where was he, I wonder?
He was in Athlone, strangely
enough.
Yeah. Not the Curragh. Yeah. But, there were 12 spies sent to Ireland in all. All his job was to send weather reports for the Luftwaffe so they'd know what the weather was like over Ireland, and also to keep an eye on flotillas or British ships or Allied ships in around Ireland so they could direct their submarines to go there. So that was his mission, but he accomplished absolutely nothing. But for that, he got 4 years in jail. Now, he describes his time in jail very interestingly. Boredom was the big thing. They were fighting amongst themselves, all the other internees and himself. They didn't speak, they didn't get on, getting in each other's nerves, obviously, but had a nice time.
Mm.
The rooms were lovely, carpets on the floor. Most Irish homes, including my own, did not have carpet at that time, I can tell you.
Yeah.
And even though they had reasonable accommodation, boredom got the better of them.
They weren't let out, were they?
No. Out all day around the place, but they could go in at night, of course.
Okay,
But they could listen to Lord Haw Haw on the radio.
Yeah. Tell people about Lord Haw Haw. That's
well, a, yeah. James Joyce, not James Joyce. What was his first name again? Joyce, anyway.
Yeah.
And he was a spokesman for Hitler, and he spoke with a wonderful sort of a semi-aristocratic sort of Anglo-Irish voice.
Yeah.
And of course, the wonderful work that the Reich was doing and the successes they had that day, and he got on everybody's nerves on this side of the water, and he would refer to Churchill very disparagingly, of course. As, by the way, did my spy.
Yeah.
When my grandmother was talking to him, he said, "Oh, we'll hang Churchill," and so on and so forth, which, of course, gave the game away. But anyway, Lord Haw Haw.
William Joyce,
Very interesting character. And they actually executed him after the war. a lot of people felt they shouldn't really, but yeah. they did.
Yeah. I'm trying to think about your grandmother now, because she kind of started it all, really. She was obviously a very observant woman, and inquisitive, I'd say, by nature.
If you're in business in England at that particular time, you know yourself, you're in business.
Yeah.
You have to keep your eye on the game, and she spotted straight away this was not a genuine character. And a single man with a German accent standing on the small bridge in Dingle at that hour of the morning at 7:30 was a bit unusual, to say the least.
Yeah.
And he also had a rasping voice. He had some operation on his larynx when he was young. So as a spy, first of all, he stood out.
He's and conspicuous,
Being a spy, being inconspicuous is what you want to achieve.
Yeah.
But I suppose the biggest giveaway was the fact that he was so different.
Yeah.
Now, all the guys who were sent to Ireland as spies, they were different. They were, very strangely, the selection was very strange. One was a circus strong man. Now, I just looked at him. He looked completely different.
Yeah, again,
there was an Indian gentleman who appeared with a white cotton suit walking around Ireland at that particular time. He stood out like a sore thumb as well.
Yeah.
The only spy that did any good, if you want to look at it like that, was Hermann Goertz. And he did some bit of spying, shall we say, as such, for a while.
Uh-huh.
Now, the German legation in Dublin weren't too happy with him either, because they didn't want to antagonise De Valera. De Valera was afraid that England would invade if Ireland were seen to be
because Ireland were a neutral country, and they were calling it the emergency. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So he wasn't. He wouldn't be too happy if and neither were the German legation. Actually, Dr. Edward Hempel, the German ambassador, was not impressed by this by this thing. Really, just sending over spies over here.
Yeah. And what would they be spying on?
Well, as I said, the weather forecast.
Weather reports, because the Luftwaffe were coming in. Yeah. Okay.
Also, the location of German or. Allies, flotillas and boats and so on.
Yeah, yeah, because this area as well, I suppose, is famous. Like, we did a documentary called Luftwaffe and Kerry about the five different crashes and there was dogfights off the Skelligs and everything in the crash in Brandon, yeah. So, yeah, it's fascinating. I wondered, like, when you were teaching, did any of these stories ever come up when you were a history teacher?
They'd come up occasionally.
Yeah.
There was one question on the Leaving Cert course where a student could pick a topic and do a special topic.
Yeah.
Special essay on that and prepare that for the exam. So the obvious thing to do is pick a local history topic.
Yeah.
Because the stuff would be available locally. Doing a big international story is more difficult. You'd have to go to Dublin to the archives and so on. Local history was the thing. So quite a few people did various stories about the history of in Dingle, including, I think, the Spy and the Snob.
Yeah, because I think in school there should be more opportunity for
absolutely,
the local history. Yeah. Because
all history is local to some
yes,
degree,
exactly. Yeah. And you're talking about something that's an international thing. That, you know, you can get the context by looking internationally, but then it gives you more of an interest, I find. Yeah.
But all the stories picked for the book, they had to have one thing in them. It had to be a good story.
Yeah.
It had to be something that anybody from any part of the world could pick it up, read the story and say, wow, that is amazing.
Yeah.
This story, I think, was the obvious one for me anyway. That one and the Cliff Rescue.
Cliff Rescue. Yeah, we'll go into it. There's a lot more stories to get to, but you operate a B&B, and I was just thinking, this book is actually great for the tourism market as well, for people that have businesses in the area as well, to know about their locality and the great stories that it has.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So much has been forgotten. I mean, even my generation, we forget all the big stories, we'll say, connected with the land war.
Yeah.
There are three or four stories, big stories in there about the land war. Local heroes. Everybody knows about Charles Stewart Parnell, about Michael Davitt, John Dillon, William O'Brien, but nobody knows about the local leaders.
Yeah.
And their names have been wiped from history, really. They should be remembered. And in my book, the ones around Dingle are remembered.
Yeah, well, you should be congratulated for that, to keep their names alive. Now, we're going to go to a break, but we are going to be speaking more with Pat Nelligan. If you want to get in touch with us, 066-712-3666. Dervis, take your calls. You can text WhatsApp to 083-300-3300.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
Yes, that's what you listened to, and I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. 066-712-3666 for your calls. Dervla's taking them, or you can text WhatsApp 083-300-3300. 100. I'm here with Pat Nelligan, the author of a wonderful collection of 14 tales, which recall some of the most notable people and events in the history of Dingle and the wider peninsula. Here are explorers and spies, soldiers and sailors, murderers, pirates, heroes and heroines and more. And it is all in this book, The Spy in the Snug and Other Tales from the Dingle Peninsula. Another story, which is a favourite of yours, Pat, is, and forgive me here now for pronouncing this, Dyksteen, the story, number 11 in the book.
The story of the Dyksteen family from Stavanger in Norway.
Yeah.
It is quite an extraordinary tale. It only came, the whole story just revealed to me as I investigated a part of the story, the rescue in the cliff. And it's in two parts. It begins in Buenos Aires in 1916. And this big, huge sailing ship, 260 feet long. And then a huge ship under full sail was sailing to Ireland. And as it passed the Fastnet Rock, the U-19, I think it was waiting, lying in wait for it, and sank the boat. They managed to get into two little boats, and they headed for the Irish coast. Now, the weather was terrible, and the boats were going up the front of the waves, down into the trough. It was an awful journey. They saw the flashing light of the Tearuct eventually. They made their way, some of them, into Ceann Siobhail, into a little cove there, and it was just an ordeal of a journey. The two boats were tied together to keep them safe, and one boat overturned in a wave, and they picked up most of the crew, but three had to stay on the overturned boat, clinging to the top of it, while the rest of them headed for the shore.
Oh.
Then when they got to shore, they turned around, came out again, and rescued the three men hanging onto the boat. Then the weather got really bad. The boat was blown right across Smerwick Harbour into this hellhole of a place called Cuasnacanana. This is a triangular cove with cliffs on each side about 800 feet high. And a small boat was inside in this, being banged around, and they had no chance of escape except for one man, Father Tom Jones. Now, Father Tom Jones has had a book written about him recently by Father Tom Looney.
The
handball man.
Kimbe, yeah.
He was the curate in Ballyferriter.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying the station mass in Ballyroe, or sorry, Ballynabuck. And they heard the commotion. Somebody saw the boat going into Cuasnacanana. About 100 people rushed to the top of the cliff, and Father Jones and three men went down into the course, which was unheard of. Vertical cliffs going down, made their way down, rescued all the men in the boat and brought them to the top safely. It was an incredible story. Now, that was what I was investigating. Then I found out that one of the men on the boat, the captain was Knut Dyksteen. And he was rescued, and he spent some time in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Dingle. He recovered from his ordeal, and he got back to Norway safely to his family. In the Second World War, about 25 years later, his son was on another boat, a huge boat as well, but he was leaving the Indian Ocean to come to Europe. And somewhere off the coast of Galway, I don't know how he got up there, but he was up there anyway, the Luftwaffe attacked the boat and sank the boat, and he and some of his crew, most of them are drowned. About six or seven of them managed to make their way to Clare Beach, drifting along in the tide and the currents. And he came ashore about 1 mile from where his father came ashore in World War One. So Knut Dyksteen Sr. landed near Cuasnacanana in 1916. His son came ashore in 1940 in Clare Beach, about a mile apart.
Whoa.
An extraordinary coincidence.
Whoa.
So I contacted the Dyksteen family. And man, they were very, very happy to hear from me and help me with some of the details about the family. And the second Knut Dyksteen also finished up, of course, in Dingle Hospital after his ordeal at sea for 5 or 6 days in an open boat.
He was Knut as well, was he? Yeah.
He was Knut also.
He was the famous King Knut of Norway.
Yeah,
yes.
But anyway, I contacted the family, and at the launch of my book, one of the family, the next generation, came to the launch of the book with her son. So this was Nina Maria Dyksteen, and she was so pleased to come to Dingle, to the place where her grandfather and great-grandfather had come ashore and spent some time in St. Elizabeth's Hospital. It's a wonderful story, and the coincidences involved in the two stories is just extraordinary.
Really. Yeah.
Oh, they both survived and both finished up in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Dingle.
Yeah, that's worth writing the book alone, isn't it, for you?
It's actually, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had been concentrating on Father Jones and Patrick O'Connor, James O'Connor, and Patrick Lynch. the men who went down into the cliff to rescue them. And their story, of course, is incredible what they did for them. Because all these people were almost unconscious. They dragged them up the cliff face.
Yeah.
Two men walking, or sorry, not walking, but climbing in front, hauling them up. And the other two behind, putting their legs into holes in the cliff, taking them up the cliff face.
Yeah.
It was an incredible story from every point of view.
Yeah. Do you know what strikes me as well? I've heard stories on Valentia Island where people would do that to rescue sheep off the cliff. And they'd lure young teenagers down to pick them up.
That's exactly where these guys had left them their skins.
Yeah.
Back to West, we call that trap. Tawkwida in trap, survive. As a sheep in a trap in the cliff.
Yeah.
And they organised things just to rescue the sheep, which was worth probably a fiver at that time, you know?
Yeah. Now but anyway, crazy stuff when you think of it.
Crazy stuff, risking life and limb. So that's where they'd honed their skills, I suppose.
Yeah. Really.
But Father Jones was an extraordinary character, and Tom Looney's book is a wonderful book about his life story. He was the handballer, of course, extraordinaire. He was a fit, strong, active man. A wrestler as well, by the way.
Yeah.
But he was the man who organised the rescue and led these men down. And King Hakon the Fourth of Norway sent a goblet especially to Father Jones to thank him for rescuing these people, and he gave him the thanks of a grateful Norwegian nation. The men were brought to Benner's Hotel, of course, for a celebration. They were presented with certificates for bravery, for rescuing life at Belly, of course, in the Canada and the West Kerry coast, and they got due recognition. But what they did was incredible.
Yeah.
These were married men, not Father Jones, obviously.
Yeah.
The other men were married men, and they went down there. Their families dependent on them. If anything happened, their families would be, as we say in Irish, in Umar na Hamilisha.
And that means?
In the depths of trouble. In real bad.
I think you're making that sound a bit nicer than
Umar na Hamilisha,
I was just thinking, Dingle or Greater organising events and festivals. There's probably a Norwegian trend that could be done there on the back of this chapter.
I intend to visiting Stavanger anyway, meeting them. I was in contact with two of the ladies of the family, Berit and Randy Dijkstein. And they are coming to Dingle as well, just to visit again. They've been here previously. They were the fifth generation of the Dijkstein family to come to Dingle. And young Olaf was the sixth, the young lad.
Yeah.
So the connection is still being maintained with Dingle.
Oh, that's excellent, Pat. Pat, stay with us. We're going to go to a break. Before that, let me remind you, if you want to get in touch with us, 066-712-3666. There will take your calls. You can text WhatsApp 083-300-3300.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney. Serving the finest seafood in a cosy, modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
Yeah, and we're talking about The Spy in the Snug and other tales from the Dingle Peninsula. This wonderful book, a publication by Pat Nelligan. Pat, before I forget it, and it's actually going to lead us on to our next story about Frobisher's Gold, but there's some wonderful photos in this book. How did you obtain those?
Most of the photographs came from my good friend, Mossy Donegan of Dingle, an old Dingle family, and I was teaching Mossy a long time ago, and he produces pictures every fortnight for the Dingle, for the West Kerry Live magazine. And since he got his drone, he's like a child with a new toy. It's fantastic. It has given him a new insight into West Kerry. All the things he pictured before from the ground, he's now doing from the sky.
Yeah.
They are fantastic. And of course, he's got the photographer's eye, which I certainly don't have, but he has in spades.
Yeah, and it really, you know, enhances the story then when you're trying to say about a harbour or a little inlet or whatever, you can actually see it and visualise it.
I should mention my friend Tom Fox.
Yeah.
Tom has all the photographs of Dingle going back over the years. He's published three books of photographs of old Dingle. And Tom gave me a lot of advice and some lovely photographs as well. And one more guy, Pather Heskira. And he also made his stuff available to me. And Noel, my other good friend, who offered me a picture, but he didn't actually use it, but he was very helpful.
Mm. Yeah, because there's illustrations in there as well, isn't there? And
That's Pather Staunton, the editor.
Okay.
Not the editor, but I suppose the illustrator and the man who designed the whole thing.
Yeah.
He's a Tralee-man, of course. He's living in Tralee.
Yeah, excellent. And Frobisher's Gold, that's another story of adventure, danger, greed and folly. And each one of these could be their own book in their own right. But tell us about this.
Well, we all know, I suppose, the massacre of Dunanore in 1580. And that is well known, 700 or 800 Spanish and Italian soldiers, a massacre on the Dunanore Peninsula. nobody ever kind of explained fully why it was called Dún an Ór, the Fort of Gold, yeah. Fort del Oro. So I decided to investigate that, and it turned out to be a fascinating story in its own right. And it just happened 2 years before the massacre of Dún an Ór. So the story is as follows, that an English privateer, a right chancer, of course they called them Elizabethan adventurers or gentlemen.
Yeah.
They were actually bloodthirsty killers, every one of them. Raleigh and all these guys, you know, the Elizabethan wars here in Munster, where they were famous for their savagery. How they treated the
Raleigh, like Walter, Sir Walter Raleigh,
Sir Humphrey Gilbert down in Cork. He was probably the worst of them all. It's worthwhile looking up Sir Humphrey Gilbert. To treat the Irish, he'd make an avenue of skulls on sticks that the Irish would have to walk through to visit him, and they could be their cousins and children.
Oh my God!
They were absolute savages.
Huh.
These were the Elizabethan gentlemen. Frobisher was one of these men, and he had been fighting against the French, and he got the brilliant idea of trying to get the Northwest Passage to China and the Orient and the riches of the East. If he could find a way north of Canada, he would have it made. The British government, of course, were very pleased because they were very jealous of the Spanish gold coming in from the New World. So Frobisher went off. He did three voyages, and the first voyage, he found a bay that went towards the left, the right direction. He called it Frobisher Straits, but it was actually a bay. It's now called Frobisher's Bay. He thought he'd found the route to the New World, but of course he hadn't. And he brought back an Inuit with him, and because he looked suitably Oriental, they thought they had it right. It was no matter of time, so he went back twice more. But during that first voyage, somebody picked up a rock and brought the rock back to England as a souvenir. Now, it sparkled. I have a copy. I have one of them at home in the house. And when you shine the light of your phone on it, it sparkles and glistens in the light. It looks like gold in the rock.
Yeah.
So anyway, he brought it back and he gave it to a guy called Michael Locke. And Michael said, there's gold in that. So he got an essayist to say, yeah, there's gold in there, but you've got to know how to get it out. So two more expeditions, 1,400 tons of ore brought back from Baffin Island in small boats. These were as big as the Dingle fishing boats then. No engine, of course, obviously. Sailing boats going to new territory. No special clothing. The rocks were broken by picks and shovels and all this kind of stuff, the usual old-fashioned methods. And the stuff brought back to Deptford to be smelted down into gold. So at that stage, it was discovered it wasn't really gold. It was rubbish. It was hornblende or fool's gold, pyrites. And the whole project collapsed after costing an absolute fortune. They had blocked a river, built a huge smelter with blast furnaces and the whole lot. And the whole thing was a waste of time. Anyway, one boat was left in the Baffin Island. It got lost among the rocks, and it was left there. But the crew found a way to the open sea, and they made their way down to catch up with the fleet. Didn't do it, and they came down the west coast of Ireland in a storm. All their sails were tattered and broken, and their masts were gone. And they finished up in Smerwick Harbour. And the boat came ashore, was beached at Smerwick. They were going to repair it. First of all, of course, they took the oar off, put it on the shore and mounted a guard because the locals might try and steal it. Not that they would. They're very honest people back there, you know. Anyway, all this was going on, and there was a dispute, actually, who owned the gold, because the local landlord reckoned it was his. It was on his land, and there was a dispute about that. But anyway, word came through that it wasn't actually gold, and it was left on the beach. The boat rotted. It was the Emmanuel of Bridgewater. And the boat was left there to rot on the sands. So, 2 years before the Battle of Dún an Ór, the English master of the rolls, Nicholas White, was there, and he said, the next day, being the 21st, we went to see the fort of Smerwick, 5 miles from the Dingle, accompanied by this, and so on and so forth. It's only the end of a rock shooting out into the Bay of Smerwick under a long cape. It's only 20 feet by 40 feet, and it's now passed by and judged by men of skill to be a place of no strength. Now, Dún an Ór was once a nice fortification, 50-foot drops on three sides and a narrow causeway into it. So long, long ago, it would have been a safe place to defend, an easy place to defend. But, of course, with the new technology, it didn't take the English long to overrun the place and kill all the soldiers. Now, everybody knows about the massacre, but it made a good bit of work to find out why it was called Dún an Ór, the Fort of Gold, Fort del Ori. And it goes back to that Martin Frobisher guy and his fool's gold. Occasionally the wind and the waves uncovers a stone. And I've got one of them at home. There's also one in the Ballyferrit Library. a brilliant example. And under the lights, if you look at it, it's sparkling and gleaming. You feel like taking it and running away with it. But it's only fool's gold.
I think this just showcases the importance of Lug Amnica and kind of people like you actually finding out before that information is lost forever. Like, you know, that now you think, oh, it's golden, oh, it's the way the sun shone there or something, you know.
That was actually
that's an amazing story. It's so rich. Story. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth herself had invested in the expedition.
Yeah, and that's the way it was at the time, wasn't it? It's kind of the monarchy or, you know.
Well, the world was their oyster, really. If there was anything to be stolen or taken or grabbed Hilford, anywhere in the world, they just took it.
Yeah, and the indigenous population suffered. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, Munster here was a kind of a laboratory for British imperialism. Uh-huh. I mean, the methods they devised here, dividing communities, you know, his chiefs were fighting that side with the weaker chief. And then when he was beaten, they would actually beat the stronger chief afterwards. I mean, that was used in India and all over Africa and so on. Mm. What happened in Munster and in Ireland was a showpiece, really, for future expansion by nearly all colonists.
There's a big game on today, but I was reading in your book that West Kerry was kind of the last stronghold of this ancient sport.
Absolutely. We were very proud of our card players in West Kerry.
Yeah.
It was the old Irish, it was a team game. Animal skin was the ball in question, and the games were huge affairs. A parish against a parish, or it could be the north side of a parish against the south side of a parish. The game started in the morning fairly early, and it went on for the day until everybody was too tired to go any further, or until you brought the card home to your local parish. So I was lucky enough to come across two stories in the archives about card being played in Dingle before 1884, when the GAA was founded. Now, card had a very bad name. Brawls were frequent. Injuries were frequent. And that time, an injury was a serious thing to a farmer, we'd say, or to his son, a young man starting off. And the church frowned on it. It was kind of wasn't encouraged, shall we say. And the police, of course, weren't happy. And a lot of the parents weren't too happy that the young men would be involved in card, which would lead to brawls.
It's like faction fighting in a way.
It was the end of faction fighting, if you like. It was so similar to it, that's why the church frowned on it. So I got two stories about card, and they referred to the village where my mum came from, Dún Sheehan, and of course the great Micheál Mura Hurtig, of course, was a Dún Sheehan man, a proud Dún Sheehan man, and he was the man, of course. He love to be around today at the Kerry Armagh commentating on it, and he thrilled us. Yeah. The whole country for years and years. I knew him very, very well, through my mum, of course.
Yeah.
But anyway, Dún Sheehan was quite famous for cod playing. They had a lovely beach down there with the banks surrounding it. It was like an amphitheatre, a kind of a... The men would play on the beach, barefooted, of course, the no shoes were allowed. They'd play all day, married men against single men. And the locals would all gather on the dunes, looking down on them, cheering on their barefoot heroes on the sand below. And they liked to travel to various other parishes to try and beat them. And Ballymore was the place they used to like to go. They were tough back in Ballymore at that time. It was a very populous place. Not so much today. But the fact that the cod games between Dún Sheehan and Ballymore went on for years. And the Ballymore men would always win. It was a source of great annoyance to the Dún Sheehan people, obviously. So they were going to go back, I think it was 1886, I think, for the last game. And the parish priest spoke out in Dingle Church that morning, no more cod. There's risk of danger to young men, serious danger. And he spoke against it anyway. And though the Dún Sheehan men went back to Ballymore, they decided, look, let's not play. So they played cards instead, which all finished up more peacefully.
Yeah. And it just shows the power the church had as well, that when they spoke, people listened.
A lot of people agree with them. Now, the church that got involved, of course, with the GAA, when the GAA was founded, it took out all the faction fighting element out of the cod.
Yeah.
And the church, the first patron was Croke, of course, Archbishop Croke of Cashel. Mm. And the church encouraged the GAA, which was a big help to them, of course, as well.
Yeah. Lovely to hear Pat Nettigan speaking on Radio Kerry this morning. Pat was a lovely teacher at the monastery school in Dingle, a gentleman to his fingertips. Congratulations on the new book from Eileen Brosnan in Lisbowl. Did you like teaching?
Loved teaching. Yeah. Absolutely loved teaching. I started off in primary. Didn't like that so much. It was Dublin in the 60s. And the classes were 55. We had 55 in each class. And three or four of us had travelled together in a car to school in the morning. And if the car was late by any chance, five teachers, we say, or four teachers would be late. And you had about 200 kids charging around the schoolyard, and the principal with a face on him like thunder. He was a Dingleman as well, James Barrett. So it kind of got us into being on time, or else all hell would break loose. Anyway, when I came back to Dingle then, 1971, the classes were about 15, 10, 20 at the most. It was a different scenario. And I found secondary teaching more congenial, shall we say, than primary teaching, with a horde of young children
in
Dublin, which was quite difficult, actually.
But I tell you, the way you describe the stories, you must have been some teacher, the way you can bring them to life. My guest is Pat Nelligan. We're talking about his book, The Spy in the Snug, and other tales from the Dingle Peninsula. If you want to get in touch with us, 066-712-3666. Dervis, take your calls. You can text WhatsApp 083 300 3300.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
066-712-3666. You can text WhatsApp 083 300 3300. We're talking to Pat Nelligan, the author of The Spy in the Snug and other tales from the Dingle Peninsula. You profile some heroines, local heroines as well, in the book, Pat.
Well, Joe, we all know the land war, the huge effect that had on Ireland when the landlord class were bought out by the British government. Think about it. They bought out all the British landlords, and the Irish farmers had to pay back the money over a period of 35 or 50 years to the Irish government. Instead of paying their landlords, they paid the government. This was a huge change in Irish society. And the Land League, Michael Davitt, Charles Stewart Parnell, O'Brien, William O'Brien, these were the leaders at national level, and they devised the policy for the Land League and the National League, which replaced the Land League. The Land League was banned after a couple of years, and the National League did most of the work, actually. And the national leaders are well known, but the local leaders at local level have been completely forgotten about, certainly in Dingle. So I felt that I should include some stories that gave recognition to some people who fought the good fight in Dingle back in the 1880s. And I picked out two ladies. The first one is a lady called Kate Fitzgerald. Kate was a widower with with nine children. Her husband had died some time previously, and she was a tiny little lady, and she refused. She couldn't pay her rent, so Lord Ventry decided to evict her onto the side of the road with her nine children, and they had nothing. They had nowhere literally to go, so she refused to be thrown out. She went back in again, took the staple off the lock on the door, went back in again. Lord Ventry pursued it. And she got, a month in jail? In Cork jail, I think. And the family had to build a sod cabin on the side of the road near the old house. And that's where they lived while their mother was in jail. Now, these are all young children, nine young children.
Imagine.
And just Lord Ventry just didn't cost him a thought to do that. So they were there on the side of the road for then. When she came out from jail anyway, she went straight to the door, took off the staple again, and went back in with her family, and the whole community sort of came to her help. So when she had the potatoes set, they came in. 90 men came in the autumn time and took out her potatoes.
90 men?
90 men turned up to show their support for
Brave.
Kate Fitzgerald.
Yeah, yeah.
And she took on Lord Ventry, if you like, and she actually succeeded. Now, she refused to pay rent, and there was no rent paid on that land for a long, long time. Sean O'Doo, the great Murrayuk historian, said, "Near Dealagain Keys, Asantalashin, Asanguathashin, O'Hinile." Now, Sean was actually wrong, because Lord Ventry hadn't gone away. And I think it was about 1921 or thereabouts, Kate was sent to jail again for a year for non-payment of rent. So when she was out of jail, she came back into Dingle, lived with her daughter. Now, she had two daughters married in Dingle, and one of them was married to Lord Baker. Now, Lord Baker is remembered to this day in a restaurant on Main Street in Dingle, Lord Baker's restaurant. And I don't know what happened. Obviously, she died in the inn, but she lived with one of her daughters in Dingle. But Kate Fitzgerald was kind of one of the local heroes of that particular time.
Yeah.
A second hero that got a little bit more, I suppose, credit was Kate Lynch. Now, Lynch's pub was where Kennedy's Bar is today in Gold Street in Dingle, across from the primary school, in Dingle, the Presentation Convent in Dingle. And there was a ban on, I suppose you'd call them emergency men. Lord Ventry, if he evicted somebody from a farm, he put somebody in to look after the farm in the meantime. So this man called Michael Walsh from from Milltown. He was an emergency man, and he came into Kate Lynch's bar for a drink and ordered a drink for himself and his wife. So she was told by somebody in the crowd, don't serve that man, he's under a ban. This was Parnell's famous...
They would be like the scabs kind of in...
So she refused to serve him, and the law was called, and she got 2 weeks in jail. And, of course, the whole town rallied around her. When she was being brought off to jail, everybody turned up. The Dingle band came out and brought her down to the mail car. Nobody would bring her to the jail, obviously, so they had to put her on the mail car. And as she went off, the whole of Dingle were cheering her on. She was released after a week, anyway, to face Lord Ventry and the judges down in the courthouse in Dingle. She was met by the Dingle band again. They came to the courthouse. Lord Ventry decided it wasn't worth the trouble, and they kind of acquitted her, but gave her a very bad character reference, that she wasn't being truthful and so on and so forth. That didn't make any difference. She left the courthouse. The Dingle band was waiting again. They paraded the town twice and brought her to her home, and she was presented with a huge gold watch. But again, implementing Parnell's boycott policy would cost her time in jail.
Yeah.
These were the local people at the coalface of the land war. I mean, Parnell, these were all well known. Nobody heard of Kate Lynch. So I think it's only fair to mention Kate Fitzgerald and Kate Lynch, two unsung heroes of the past.
You're proud of them. I can see the way you're talking.
Absolutely. Yeah. These were Dingle people fighting for the rights of Dingle farmers and Dingle people. It was just wonderful, I think.
Yeah, and the Dingle band were playing them off.
The Dingle band, I'm happy to say, are still alive and well and performing even better than ever under their wonderful master, Fergus O'Flaherty, my next door neighbour. The original band was a brass band.
Yeah.
You can imagine the noise they'd make going around the town. Now we have the Dingle Fife and Drum Band. It has even excelled the exploits of the old Dingle Brass Band.
Yeah,
they are famous in song and story, especially on the Rans Day.
Yeah. Nelligan's Pub, I mean, we only have about a minute, but how long is it in operation? That's where your grandmother...
Well, my grandmother, I think, opened the shop.
Yeah.
And the strange thing is that her name appears in the documents. In the books that, you know, the records of sales and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Even though her husband was obviously doing quite a lot of the work in the background, I presume.
Yeah.
But she opened it about 1906, and it's still in the family. It passed from my grandfather and grandmother to my father, and from him to my brother Michael, who still owns the place, but he doesn't like the bar business, really, so he rents it to somebody else.
Yeah.
The Begleys, I think, one of the Hurley boys, Michael Hurley's son, Dara, I think he rents it, and it's a great centre for music, Irish music.
Yeah, and 120 dancing. Years.
Yes.
Yeah, because we'll be talking about a pub in the next hour, you know, that's 100 years, and the building goes back to the famine. Amazing. Pat, we're out of time. Where can people avail of your book?
Well, the Dingle Bookshop, I think, in Dingle, and the Cafe Littera, of course, Shorsha and the Cafe Littera, Garvey Supermarket, and in Tralee here we have the Polymath, James O'Connell. James, anyway.
Yeah.
He stocks the book as well.
Yeah.
So it's available online from the Dingle Bookshop.
So it's in all good bookshops, and you can get it online as well. Pat, it's been an absolute pleasure, and we're getting a lot of texts in here, and they have the same kind of a theme. They're all saying you're a gentleman, so that's brilliant above everything else. Congratulations to Pat.
Don't really know me.
Congratulations to Pat, a real gentleman from Helen Griffin and family in Lisbowl. It's called The Spy in the Snug and Other Tales from the Dingle Peninsula. Pat, it's absolutely brilliant. It's a book that I'm going to continuously be in and out of, and telling people the stories as well, because that's what I think you've created here, is you've actually taught a man how to fish as well. You haven't just fed them the fish, because people will be able to tell other people these stories as well, and that's what keeps the memory of these people alive.
Exactly.
Then if you can tell someone the story of these women you were talking about and everyone else, which is brilliant, and ordinary people from Dingle, which is brilliant.
Who did extraordinary things.
Exactly. A lovely way to finish. Pat, continued success, Co Gardagus, and I look forward to the next project, and continued health and happiness to you and your family.
See you in 9 years' time.
That was the last time you were in. To Paul Falta. Right, we're going to go to a break, and then we're going to have the news. And in the next hour, I went along to Bridie's, or Keating's Bar, in Derry Nan, and we'll also have Aisling Roach, and she has an exhibition in the Grills Gallery in Clorglan.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan's Seafood Bars. Packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today.
Yeah, and I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. We're into the second hour of the programme and very shortly we'll be going to my interview I did with Jura Keating of Bridie's, or Keating's Bar in Derrynane, which is celebrating 100 years next weekend. And the building itself goes back to the famine times. And of course, we'll be talking about the legendary Bridie herself, who passed away in 2018, was a proprietor there for many years and was very much part an institution in the area. But now I'm delighted to say we're going to be talking to Aisleen Roach about her new exhibition in Grills in Killorglan, drawing inspiration from maritime ecological systems. Aisleen, how are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you, Joe.
So tell us, what is the inspiration behind it? I mentioned maritime ecological systems, but that's kind of your field, isn't it?
Well, I grew up spending my summers in a little village outside of Cork called Myrtleville. And I learned how to swim in the sea there, and I've been kind of a bit of a water baby ever since then. So the work is always inspired by the ocean, about the sea. And more recently, it's inspired by all of the issues that are facing us as a result of climate change and pollution. So I'm just drawing attention to some of those issues, but really celebrating the sea more than anything else.
Mm. We did a documentary, it's a few years ago now, called Plastic Generation, and the damage that has been done to our sea life, which are just so important to our overall existence.
Absolutely, yeah. And I had the great experience of spending time on the Science Vessel Tom Green with marine scientists last year, and we were looking at actually an awful lot of plastics, looking at microplastics in the water, but we did a whole range of experiments and kind of interventions, also just collecting data, all to do with the marine and conserving our marine systems.
Mm. Tell us about your own work then, and the work that people will see in the exhibition.
So I have kind of three main themes to the show. So the first is a themes of circulation, and around that it's really about the flow of water, how long it takes a drop of water to travel around the whole circulation system of our oceans, which is 1,000 years. It's about memory, about my childhood, about my memories of being at the sea. And one of the things that I do remember is coastal erosion. And a very big part of a garden that I used to go to has now fallen into the sea. So I've addressed that in some of the work. And then I have a third aspect to it, which is scientific intervention, and about how, you know, in science now we're actually making corals to try and create corals, which is kind of nuts, but good.
and the work is porcelain.
Yeah, that's right. It's a mixture of all mediums. So there's photography, porcelain, drawing, but it's predominantly porcelain.
Yeah, and that's a metaphor in itself, isn't it? Because it is delicate to work with, and kind of our oceans are in a delicate stage at the moment.
It's a temperamental material, and it's very it is very, very tricky to work with. It is incredibly fragile and can be very, very finely worked. So it's also a metaphor for our oceans. I kind of think of it as, you know, a material that its materiality reflects the fragility of our oceans, and it's also quite strong. So, you know, it is the same in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
NACRIA, NACRIA, is it?
Yeah. So that's a word I made up myself, really. But it came from Nacre, which is mother of pearl.
Okay.
And that's kind of a metaphor for the show. So mother of pearl is, you know, that the substance that forms inside the shells to protect the whatever species is growing in the shell.
So that's very smooth.
Yeah. It's how pearls are made.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful. The significance, I suppose, of, you know, exhibited in such a fine space as the Griddles Gallery, you know, in this county of Kerry, this coastal county, we're surrounded by wonderful rivers, lakes and ocean. I suppose that must be kind of a privilege for you, is it?
Oh, it's amazing. It's such a beautiful space. And Lucy and Robert are fantastic people to work with. It is my second exhibition in the Grills. And because I had been there before, I was able to really think about the site when I was creating the show. And so I really thought about each of the gorgeous spaces in there and where I was going to put everything as I was making it, which was a real privilege. So I have one piece in there that's called Sea Worms. And it's they're sort of long, thin porcelain pieces that are hanging from the ceiling. And they're based on an experience that I had swimming off Hare Island, where I actually saw these sea worms coming out of the mud and feeding. And it was such a beautiful experience because they're normally very shy and they disappear. But because it was murky, they didn't see me.
Do you know, art, I suppose, it provokes and it gets you thinking. And this is why this kind of work is so important, because it is serving that kind of two-pronged approach. You know, it's the art, it's beautiful, but it's also getting people thinking about where they live, what they can do as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very much about a celebration, but it's also a warning. And it's, you know, it's all of us know. We know all of the things now. We're hearing it on the media all the time. You know, we've got fast fashion. We're using too many plastics. We have to think about recycling. And all of these things make a difference. And we really have to think about all of that, how we're using our planet and what we can do to, as an individual, because essentially we're all just one drop of water in the ocean, you know, and every single one of us matter and we all can all make a difference.
Yeah.
So it's really about that, yeah.
Yeah, there's a Q&A coming up on the 28th as well. Tell us about that.
So myself and Dorota Borowa, who actually exhibited at the Grills last September, she's going to chat to me about my show and ask questions about various bits and pieces that are in there. Her work is also concerned with the water, so it's a very nice meet for the two of us. So I'm really looking forward to that.
What time is that on?
So on the 28th at 12 noon in the Grills.
In the Grills.
And it's free and everybody's welcome.
Yeah, and the exhibition is on until when, or what days is it running?
It finishes on the 28th.
Okay, so a nice time. Yeah. And they're always welcoming there, Robert.
5 o'clock on the 28th is the last. The door closes.
Yeah. Dorota is so talented. I interviewed her as part of an artist kingdom where we profile artists. And I was actually just as part of this program, really. But there was one where you went into it and you thought you were in, I don't know, the north or the south pole or somewhere. It transported you.
Amazing.
It was reflection, and it was just, and all that. The variety of her work is so impressive, and even the way she got the local community involved as well. And that's what I love about the Grills Gallery. It's making art so accessible to the community as well.
It is. It's an amazing place, and it's becoming more and more immersed in the arts community, the greater arts community as well, not just in Kerry. All of us in Cork are very much aware of it, and anybody I know who's had an exhibition there feels like that it's been a privilege.
Yeah, well, Aisling, thanks a million for coming on, and continued success with that and everything else you do, and best luck with the Q&A on the 28th as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Aisling Roach there. Her new art exhibition is in the Grills Gallery, Killorglin. And it is, she works primarily in porcelain, but drawing inspiration from maritime ecological systems. And like all artists, she actually has great variety in her work as well. Now, very soon after this break, we're going to be going to Derry Nan, and we're going to be talking to Jor Keating about the famous Bridies. In that region, some wonderful history celebrating 100 years, and the building itself goes back to the famine times. And actually, there's a photo on the wall there of Frank Lewis from this program interviewing Bridie herself. So obviously there was a Saturday supplement held there a number of years ago as well. We're going to take a break and we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals. Available in store.
Now, an establishment that has become part of the fabric of daily life and the landscape of Derrynane and Cardaniel and the surrounding area is Bridie's, as it is affectionately known as, or Keating's Bar. And I went along during the week to meet Geraldine Keating to find out about all the history of this place that goes back to almost the famine times. Now, I'm here in this wonderful establishment, Bridie's, in Derrynane Moor, just down from the village of Cardaniel, in one of the most scenic places in the world. And this building and this area has an amazing amount of history. And I'm delighted to say I'm here with the current person that's run it. It's our establishment, Jor Keating. Jor, thanks a million for welcoming me here. And I'm not exaggerating when I say this place has a lot of history. But first of all, I introduced the place as Derrynane, not Derrynane Moor. And why did I do that?
Well, you'd be very, very... there's one woman looking down at you that'd be very proud of you, Joe. because Bridie Keating always insisted that it was spelled and pronounced Derrynane Moor.
Yeah. And
that was going back to the actual Irish for the area. So at the period where the place was being mapped, the English kind of made some of the notes and the names more of a phonetic spelling. So they lost the Irish with it. So the it's A spelling, Derrynane, would be from the Irish meaning oak.
Yeah. And not far from here is Eilean d'Avra, Island of the Oaks, Valentia Island. And that is also called Bailinche, then they say mouth of the harbour. So, but it's amazing the way, you know, the names of places have been changed. We should kind of claim them back. So if you're referring to Derrynane, no, you should be saying Derrynane. Let's go back to where this all began. I couldn't believe before we started this interview how far back this building actually goes.
Yes, Joe, it really actually, the building itself was part of the Daniel O'Connell estate, his ancestral home. So the building itself, we feel like what we can honestly say that is, you know, on maps from the area, goes back to 1850 and probably earlier than that. And the actual the first Keating on the scene would have been Daniel Keating in the 1880s. And he was working for the owner of the O'Connell estate, a descendant of Daniel O'Connell, the liberator. But his name is also Daniel. And
was he called after him, do you think?
He was. I think those two, you know, in families, the tradition of the same names. So I think in the O'Connell family, it's Daniel and Morris. So like in the Keating family, it's Daniel and Michal. So we have the same gen. My nephews are Donald and Michal, you know. So it was the first fella of the Keatings was Daniel Keating, and he did accounts for the owner at the time of the 1880s at the Derrynane estate. So that's actually where the transfer came about of the ownership back in the 1880s. And Bridie's father, Michal Keating, was born in this house after they took over. And he was born in 1888 in this home. And the couple, the first Keatings, that was Daniel Keating and Nora O'Neill. They ran it from day one as the Derrynane, was spelled with the A, Derrynane Hotel. So they did they'd have people coming from Dublin and different areas, and they would come by train to Carseveen, and they would be met in Carseveen by the pony and trap. And they'd be brought down here.
Service.
Yes, great service is great. And it was like angling, you know, they're anglers, but they were, the photos that we have are very so indicative of the time. They really dressed so well, even when they're going out fishing in their tweeds and things like that, you know, and then their tennis whites and such. And the area that we have now that there's some, you know, camping going on, that was always referred to by the family, my father's and Bridie's generation, as the tennis courts, because there were tennis courts here when it was originally the Derrynane Hotel. They had their guests able to have their fishing and their tennis, and, you know, they're just kind of let their hair down in this lovely, tranquil, beautiful, you know, seaside location.
So it, like, it was a tourist area, so from very early on, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely. So it was part of the, when the Great Southern was kind of marketing the area as such. So they were kind of drawing from people that would be coming from all over, and lots of people from England and the UK as well.
Yeah, because Queen Victoria's visit to Killarney really kick-started that as well, yeah.
Correct, and it would have been kind of all at that time when everyone started to take a real interest in this lovely jewel of the area that we have here today.
Yeah, so it was a hotel, and you were telling me something very interesting then about how the locals used to frequent this place before, I suppose, it was a public house, really.
Yes. So as when they were, since the 1880s, they were able to serve drink to their overnight guests. But the locals would have to come around the back of the house and be served out what was called the hatch. So it was actually a hatch license that they had to serve bottles out the at the hatch, and they could take the bottle away, but they couldn't drink it on the premises. So it was really kind of a precursor to the off license, this hatch license. So when Bridie's parents married in 1926, they were given the running of the establishment, and they really made it their first order of business to apply for the public house license. And in order to do that, they had to have a designated bar room here. So pretty much where we're speaking from today, it hasn't changed much in the 100 years since.
Wow. It's quite a small room, isn't it? But it's so cozy and welcoming. And I'd imagine that's what people have loved over the years, as well as Bridie, I'd admit.
Of course. Well, she was certainly the and well-deserved legend that she was known for her welcome and her great wit and her just she really just oozed the hospitality of the area and her family and the history. She was so always so delighted to tell you the history of the family and the area. And she could tell, many people tell me today that she was able to tell them about their genealogy and their connections to the area. And she just, you know, it was a great gift she had because she was so interested in
Interested. So when did she take it over?
So she was in the Bank of Ireland on O'Connell Street in the early 1960s, like many women, young women went. And she was doing well there. And then when her father became quite poorly, and it was, you know, kind of, he wasn't going to recover. In the mid-1960s, she came back from Dublin. And so since 1965, she was actually the proprietor of the bar, which was known at that time as Keating's Bar.
Yeah.
Because she got the... rightly so, she deserved the accolades, and it was always referred to after she took over as Bridie's Bar. But she would never have the hubris to change the name after and call it after herself. But so she always paid rates on Keating's Bar. We still pay rates on Keating's Bar, but it's just affectionately throughout the country known, you know, just by anyone who was here and enjoyed her hospitality. It was always just referred to, you know, locally and just out of affection as Bridie's.
As Bridie's. Yeah, that's Ger Keating there, and we'll return to that interview after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
Now let's return to my interview with Ger Keating of Bridie's in Cahir Daniel. Did Bridie ever marry?
No, she didn't.
And so that's how the Keating name kind of stayed then as well.
Yes. And she was the There were seven children. So to say, my grandparents, the ones who married in 1926 and put the went for the public house license, they were blessed with seven children, and Bridie was the sixth of the seven.
Okay, and there's a photo of them there on the wall. So go through them. Who are they?
So seated there are the parents there, and that would be Michal and Bridie, and on next, it's the usual tradition, right, would be the older ones would be able to sit in a photograph.
Yeah, right?
There was always some kind of
seniority
honor,
in it.
Given to that. So on his mother's side is Donal. They was known and that as Donal or Doey by the family affectionately, and that was my father, and. Then on the other side of Michal, that's Maura. And Maura went to England. She went to London. She was trained as a nurse. And then standing just behind her is her sister Eileen. And she trained as a teacher, and she went off to Manchester. Next to her is Margaret, and Margaret married a guard. She met him here in Carrigdaniel. And I guess the official rules at the time were if you married a local, you had to be transferred out of the area. So they ended up in Waterford. And then standing behind his mother is Father Michal. And he was a priest, and he spent many years in Glasgow.
Yeah.
And later in Donegal.
It's like the obligatory priest or nun in the family,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And then Carmel is standing next to her brother, Michal. And Carmel, she was the youngest of the seven, and she married Josie Keating from Carsaveen.
Yeah.
So she was Carrie Keating, and she married Josie Keating. Yeah. So Keating married Keating, so all sorts of Keating relations there.
So that's the connection, because people often think there's a straight line to Josie Keating to here, but it's through marriage, yeah. And Josie was some character. I interviewed him in his house, and what an entrepreneur, an amazing man as well. So, all right, so he married Carmel, which, you know, I'm just thinking that I never knew that rule about if a guard married a local, they'd have to be transferred out. It was some sacrifice, wasn't it? You'd want to be sure.
Exactly, wouldn't it be? But I don't know if it's still in existence.
Back
but
then, yeah.
Back then, yeah, so he was in the barracks there, just on the main road there, and they would have met, because she was living here at the time. But and then the last one in the photograph is Bridie herself.
Okay, so there was two Bridies.
Yes.
Yeah, that's mad. Your own father, he immigrated as well. Tell us his story.
Well, he was the eldest, and then right after, you know, the war, when the borders opened up again, his mother was kind of made the sacrifice herself, really, because in those days you didn't know how often you'd be able to see them once they left. But she the parents encouraged them to go, over, and they actually had to arrange. In those days, you had to be sponsored by someone who kind of, they had to, say you were a person of good, character, and you were going to be gainfully employed, and you were, so you couldn't just go. So it was his mother that arranged the for that sponsorship, and. As like life has all these very interesting layers to it, but so his mother was a teacher, and she trained as a teacher with a woman in Mayo and in Bohola, and their name was Dwyer, her maiden name was Dwyer, the family name was Dwyer, and her son, her brother, this woman Dwyer's brother was the current sitting mayor of New York City.
Handy.
Yes. Bill O'Dwyer, who's kind of like a real, kind of iconic figure in Irish America because, yeah. I mean, it was amazing to see like in such a position that it was an actual Irish-born man, So she pulled all her favors. She knew the top fella there. So anyway, they were able to sort my father out to get his sponsorship.
And what year was that?
That would have been 1949.
Okay, yeah. So he went to New York. And where did he settle in New York? New York's fairly famous for the Irish people. Lots of different boroughs. There's Queens, Yonkers, and the Bronx. So where did he settle?
Well, he settled in Manhattan there. They fellas got kind of very creative. And because he was handy out, because of the raised in this with the hotel business, always fixing toilets and, fixing anything that was broken. So he was a superintendent of a building, if you will. They called them the super in New York. They'd say the super of the building would be the fella that had the little apartment in the building, but they were the ones you called if you had any problem, So you get a discounted rate, and he had roommates and all. So they had a great time.
Yeah, and he'd know everyone then.
Yes, exactly. But also, so he went straight from Derrynane GAA, playing GAA, to straight to New York Gaelic Park, which was kind of the thing at the time.
Yeah.
Got sorted once you went to GAA. So he got stuck in right away. And he always had an office held an office in the New York GAA. He was president of the GAA for a long time.
Really?
In the 1960s and early 70s. So I remember as a child the phone calls coming into the house, which of course at those days was one house phone, and children didn't answer the phone because that was serious business.
Yeah.
But people would be ringing him saying, "Oh, Donald, I have a nephew coming over, and he might be from Cork or, wherever they, because he would know them. These United Irish counties would be kind of, they were all Irish, you know what I mean? Once you go to New York, it's not so much, oh, you're Kerry and I'm Donegal or whatever. You're Irish, we're together, we're going to get, they really built a community. It was a really close community. But he'd get these phone calls and he'd say, right, okay. And then he'd think, who does he know from that county? And he'd get them, he'd say, it's up to you after that. I'll make the introduction. If he has you, make an appointment with me to come see him for a job. And don't come on time. You come 15 minutes early, because after that, you're late. And so it was great the way that community really was something, to see it as children. They really looked after each other.
Whoa. Where did he meet your mother, and who was your mother?
My mother was Eta. Well, Henrietta was her full name, very fancy name. And they nicknamed her Eta. And she met my father at an Irish dance in New York City in Manhattan. He was hanging out with the Mayo people because of the Mayo sponsorship connection there. She was from Knock County, Mayo herself. And so that's where the romance blossomed there. And he went to Korea. He was drafted, actually, into the U.S. Army. And he served in the U.S. Army for 2 years before before being discharged. And it was kind of, they were very fortunate because in those days, Joe, if you weren't a citizen yet, they didn't, like today, if you were, to serve, you would be automatically made a citizen. Yeah. But then you weren't. You had to do your same time, through the citizenship. So there were some Irish that were, unfortunately, they didn't survive, the conflict, and their parents, were not kind of eligible for U.S. Government the way they would look after a citizen. So that was changed, thankfully, in later years. But they did have certain ones they would speak of that, that they would have served with that had perished. And it was just one of those wrongs that were eventually righted anyway.
Did your father get to come home much?
He was able to because more than, say, many at the time, because of the GAA, because he was president of the New York GAA, they would have come for Easter Congress. Okay. I don't know if that's still in existence, but that was something that they would, that part of your duties were to kind of these elections and such. So he'd come for that. And he'd often come That's why I always, even though I know it's changed, but in our minds, we always think of the All-Ireland and being September, because that's always when they went over.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it was always people ringing on the phone again, looking for tickets to over if they were going to, you know, I've got so-and-so, you know, going over. Do you have a ticket type of thing? Yeah.
So he did get to come here. And by, did you get a chance then to come as kids, or when did he start coming over here?
We did. It wasn't like today where, you know, babies, you know, 5 months old have passports now. But it was a different time, but it was very special when we were able to come over. And of course, our grandmother was still living in those days. And it was really special to come. And if we came at a different time, maybe by a week, we'd be meeting an auntie and some first cousins maybe we hadn't met before because of the London, Manchester, other parts of Ireland here, you know, and they'd be coming over, the sisters would be coming over to help Auntie Bridie with the kind of the summer tourists and her business here, you know, making food up and sandwiches and things like that, bring out to the beach. So we had a really, really special, it always was like people who say today, oh, I remember Darren Ann so well. It was always with my family. So for us, it was similar, similar to that. But when you say about the, how did we get over the GAA again? As they're very wise fellas there. And that was back in the day when, for a fundraiser, Joe, they would charter a plane, say, from Pan Am or from Eastern or TWA or whoever, Aer Lingus maybe. And they'd actually hire the plane and hire the crew for a certain amount. And in those days, you had to use a travel agent to book airline tickets.
Yeah.
So the GAA would run, say, a tour for going 2 weeks, say, in August or whatever it might be. And they'd have so many seats that they would sell. But they would sell it for less than what the travel agent would book it for. And so basically all the Irish would want to bring their families over to come visit their, obviously the young ones born in New York would be brought back to home to meet their, you know, to have some time with their nana and their granddad and their cousins. So it was kind of a different, it was hard to imagine that it was, but that's how often, you know, if there was extra seats and things like that, that's how he would kind of get us to come over. And it was like always last minute, and it was always like, you know, something that was just great excitement. Flying was so different than today.
Yeah. And did you grow up in Manhattan, or
they moved to New Jersey suburbs. So it was northern New Jersey, just over the George Washington Bridge.
Yeah.
And so
near Englewood or close?
Yeah. Right next to the very next town. Yeah. Teaneck
was okay. Because my grandaunt was a nun, and there's a convent there, she lived there. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We actually, one of my mom's cousins was there as well.
Whoa, small
one.
It's stunning, like looking down to George Washington Bridge, looking down
really
the Hudson.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
And so I'm just trying to get it in my head. You're in that really popular, a cosmopolitan, busy, most famous city in the world, and you come to Derrynane for your holidays, which is at the opposite end, but it's beautiful.
It was magical. It really was. That's the only word you can say. It was really just, even talking about it, you see, I have the broadest smile on my face because it's just, it really just evokes that to you.
Yeah.
Just like anyone in our family who was coming even from Carsevine down here, or, you know, to, you know, from Waterford or Tipperary or Dublin. Everyone was just, it was a real getaway, wasn't it, from even here in Ireland. But certainly those that were in London and in Manchester felt the same as well.
Yeah, what a great story Ger Keating has to tell. Now we'll return to the final part of that interview after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan's.
Now let's return to the final part of my interview with Ger Keating of Bridie's in Caher Daniel. So how did it come about that you ended up running this place?
Well, I tell you, you know the expression, it takes a village.
Yeah. There.
Well, certainly it's support of the family was really, really felt and appreciated because, who can step in but you had to step in and do your best after my auntie Bridie passed away.
Yeah.
You know, even though she was a good age, she was 83 when she passed. God rest her soul. But
that must have been like a train though hitting you at the same time, I'd imagine, because she's like an institution here.
Yes. And you know what? That sounds so naive. That's even the words coming out of my mouth. But you just never thought of her going, know what I mean? At the time. But Josie Keating and our Auntie Carrie, and just because they were the locals here in Kerry, and Maura Keating was my cousin, my first cousin. They were so good in really helping us to find our way, you know, because there's certain things that had to be done, obviously, when there's a transfer, and things that needed to be done, because things that were, everything has to be relicensed. So maybe things that were okay for when it was just renewing our aunt's license, we had to make certain repairs and do certain things with that were required. So our Uncle Joe was amazing with that because he was I have a man for that, or I know just the one for that. And it was just really so kind because I think it would have been so overwhelming, really, and you wouldn't know where to start.
Yes.
So it was this feeling of, we'll do it together. You know, we'll get the door open and we'll, you know, because that was the big push, Joe, was to make sure she passed away, God rest her, in January. Just after the new year, it was the 12th of January.
And what year?
2018.
Okay.
So for ourselves, we really wanted to keep the continuity of Summers in Derry Nant. So, so we were able, with all this help of the family and all the different families in within the Keating family, to open the door right, you know, the last week of May into the June weekend. And that's what we continue to do because the summers really are so tremendous and you really feel like, my gosh, we have to have the door open for that special, you know, time for so many families. And, you know, even every year, you know, there's a new families that are finding it for the first time.
Yeah, but it's a big deal for you. You come over from America, don't you, to run a dinner every summer?
I'm fortunate, though. I'm able to work remotely.
Okay. You know,
and I do fundraising. So the way I put it is, so my deal to them is they don't have to pay me in the summertime. They're very happy to take that deal. And that's, and so I run, you know, with all the help that we have, we run the pub for the summer together.
Do you must love it, I'd say. Is the spirit of Bridie kind of still here when you're running it? Do you feel like that you're kind of continuing it on?
There really is a sense of that. And actually, also because she instilled in all the family, any one of my cousins would tell you, the expression she'd say to us was, you have to keep up the standards of the house, right? So I always say, sometimes I feel like, Joe, I'm not sure if I'm quite there, but that the willingness and the effort is there to try to continue it. But everyone bands together and really just, I think it's a labor of love. And also people are just pleased that the institution is here. And I think, as you mentioned, part of the charm is, I think for a lot of people, is that it hasn't changed. Like we'll have somebody come in now, you sitting in the bar, you see all these it's nearly not a spot on the wall that doesn't have a photograph on it.
Yeah.
So our feeling is we can always add the photos where we can, but we can't take anything or move anything because, like the first summer, somebody came in and said, he walked in and he said, looks up on the wall and he said, that's my father in that photograph. Oh. And I haven't been here since 1982 or whatever. And he was just so pleased. He was bringing his teenage children in and it made such a difference to him to see that his father's photograph was still on the wall. So that just, that's what it's about. And somebody will come in, you know, any week in the summer and they'll say, you know, that's my granduncle, or that's my, he was a brother of my father's, or do you know what I mean? People have a real connection to a lot of because these locals, to be up there on the wall, you had to be a bit of a legend yourself, I'd say, right?
Yeah, I see Frank Lewis is up there. The Saturday Supplement was obviously conducted here before because he's inside there with Bridie. So they obviously did a wonderful historical episode from here as well. I just feel a bit overwhelmed by the whole thing because you're talking about history. And like, I'd imagine for yourself, there's a huge amount of responsibility to keep the thing going because everyone's talking about that it's very tough to keep public houses going and everything else. But it strikes me, it's like a community centre. Families are coming back and maybe they've lost loved ones and the next generation is coming back and coming back and coming back. So this place means a lot to people.
It does. It really does. And as you say, also the location now, you know, because of the location, the funerals that go, they have to pass the house here, you know, for the burial up in Abbey Island. So that's always been a very important tradition here. So we still continue that, you know, if it's the summer ones or into the fall when we'd still be here. And it's just recognizing that it really is a community treasure. And really, we wouldn't be able to continue without the support of the community. So we really appreciate the openness of people to do what they can to help us as well.
You're celebrating 100 years on the 27th of June in the afternoon. Tell us about that. Are you famous lamb sandwiches, isn't it? Are you famous for those?
Oh, well, Bridie was very famous for them and we continue on with those. Yes, absolutely. So there'll be plenty of lamb sandwiches. Yes, they're on the menu every day that we're open. But yes, so what we're celebrating is the when we were talking about my grandparents marrying in 1926. So they went for that public house license then. So it's 100 years on.
Whoa.
So the family are gathering, the Keating family. So we, throughout the summer, people are making their way over to visit when they can. But that particular weekend seemed to have, for whatever reason, more people looking to come that weekend. So we said, well, that makes great sense for us because obviously it's the beginning of the season. And their wedding anniversary is nearly is that weekend as well.
Oh,
it is literally 100 years that weekend. So we're delighted to have the community join us. So we're going to have music and we're going to have all sorts of fun, you know, for the children. And we'll have some tasty bites and sweet treats. And I think we have plenty of the Guinness and all the taps are the same as when our auntie Bridie ran it. So we tried to change as little as we can.
So everyone's welcome on the 27th. When is it kicking off?
So it's kicking off 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Excellent. Jor, it was an absolute pleasure coming in here. I can't get over the history and so beautifully told by yourself. And at times that was emotional, I'd say, for you when you're going through different elements of it, because it is a storied past and you're in every ounce of this building. And Bridie, I can feel her inside with me here. It's amazing. So best of luck on the 27th. Cogargus, congratulations, and enjoy the great celebration here at Bridie/Keating's in Darrynan Moor on the 27th.
Thank you very much now, Joe. You're so kind. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I want to wish Jor all the best with their celebration. What a wonderful occasion that will be, and full of nostalgia, no doubt. And hopefully the sun shines down on them, because there's no better place in the world when the sun is shining than Darrynan. But once again, thanks to Jor there, and I wish them all the best to all the Keatings. Now, that's all we have time for on the programme this morning. My thanks to Abigail Bernard, who was on sound. Frank Lewis will be up next Saturday, so I'll be back again in 2 weeks' time for our monthly and focus photography slot. And our theme is capturing the moment, or capturing a moment. So you can email them to jmcgill@radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks' time. Until then, look after yourself and take care.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.